This is Audible.
Audible presents Real Time by Regis McKenna, published by Harvard University Press. Introduction. A man or a woman suddenly thrust into this world would have to dodge houses and buildings, for all is in motion. Houses and apartments mounted on wheels go careening through Bahnhofplatz and race through the narrows of Marktgasse, their occupants shouting from second-floor windows. The Post Bureau doesn't remain on Postgasse, but flies through the city on rails like a train. When a person comes out of his front door at sunrise, he hits the ground running, catches up with his office building, hurries up and down flights of stairs, works at a desk propelled in circles, gallops home at the end of the day. Why such a fixation on speed? Because in this world, time passes more slowly for people in motion. Thus, everyone travels at high velocity to gain time. Alan Lightman, Einstein's Dreams, 1993. The collapse of time and space. Time once seemed the most reliable dimension guiding life on Earth. Time was a matter of the sun passing over the meridian to mark yet another day. And life, in relation to greater and smaller fragments of time, had a similar evenness, a reassuring predictability. Things took just so long, everyone counted on it. The notion of what you could accomplish in an hour or an afternoon was roughly as fixed and immutable as the 9 odd months between the conception and birth of a human being. No more. A sense of time speeded up has become pervasive as we close out the century. Our appetite for speed is insatiable. Our preoccupation with time so relentless that it is playfully explored not just in science fiction, but in novels in the literary mainstream. Faster is no longer enough. The search for the instantaneous and simultaneous has become the 1990s equivalent of the quest for the Holy Grail. My personal index of the change in our perception of time takes me back to childhood family vacations in the early 1950s. We traveled from Pittsburgh to Lake Erie, little more than 100 miles away. Yet the trip required such enormous planning and preparation that it might have been a military exercise. My father spent at least one day making sure that our car, a 1937 Buick, was in the best possible working condition. That was because we usually left on weekends, when, thanks to the blue laws of the era, garages as well as grocery stores and all other business enterprises were closed. For days, my mother shopped for and arranged all the clothes a family of 7 boys would need. In the hours before we left, she packed bags and made lunches and brewed coffee for our meal en route. These yearly journeys were pleasant, and I have many fond memories of them, but it often took longer to prepare for the vacation than to actually take it. The trip to Lake Erie was not just a journey of physical distance, it was also a journey of perception. Today, often at a moment's notice and with no preparation, I drive 100 miles to have lunch or breakfast with a client in San Francisco. Frequently, I travel to Dallas, New York, or Tokyo, thousands of miles away, for a 2-hour meeting and return within 48 hours. Like most everyone else, when on a trip, I expect to do a lot more than just get from one place to another. I no longer experience a journey's duration as mere travel time, but time to read or write, work on my portable computer, watch a movie, eat a 3-course microwave dinner, make telephone calls, send a fax, or perhaps listen to music. Everything is designed to make travel not feel like travel. The complexity and effort of travel are made transparent as time and space are transformed. Having technology at our fingertips makes us more productive, but it also presents us with the challenge of cramming in yet more, of accounting for every second. Whether in our offices, our cars, or our kitchens, we are aware that time is money, time is precious, time waits for no one. Even today's teenagers, carrying beepers and cellular phones, reflect these proliferating potent truths. Using the alphanumeric capability of their pagers, teens commonly answer demands on their time with 24/7, meaning, I am booked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. In the world at large, in the space of a mere decade, we have witnessed many unexpected turns of events: the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union, the rise of China as a world trading power, the exploding bubble of the Japanese economic miracle, the demise of the Democratic Party's 40-year dominance of the U.S. Congress, the transformation of Vietnam from adversary to U.S. trading partner, the embrace of peace by Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin, the assassination of Rabin, the displacement of uplifting images of Olympic winter sports in Sarajevo with a savage ethnic war, and the separatist revolt in Quebec. During this same brief time span, the term Internet became a household word. Racing past us like simulations of warp speed travel, these events filled the media and our lives, conditioning our view of the world around us. Those of us in business must keep reminding ourselves that this supercharged world is the marketplace, a marketplace in which the ticking of real-time technologies is teaching the consumer to expect and demand immediate satisfaction. We are resetting our clocks to real time. Imagine a world in which time seems to vanish and space seems completely malleable, where the gap between need or desire and fulfillment collapses to zero, where distance equals a microsecond in lapsed connection time, a virtual world created at your command. Imagine a world in which everything you do, from work to education, is clothed as an entertainment-like experience, veiled by technology so subtle and transparent that you have no idea it is there at all. Habits, attitudes, opinions, preferences, expectations, demands, perceptions, and needs all adapt unwittingly to an environment in which immediacy rules. All of this may sound like material for a science fiction thriller, but it is very nearly the world we are living in today. Technology is transforming our existence in profound ways, and the pace of change is speeding up, not slowing down. Almost all technology today is focused on compressing to zero the amount of time it takes to acquire and use information, to learn, to make decisions, to initiate action, to deploy resources, to innovate. When action and response are simultaneous, we are in real time. For managers all over the world, the buzz is about time to market, just-in-time manufacturing, quick time, internet time, time-based management. In companies, as in life, we seem to be feeling the strain of an evolutionary resetting of some internal organic clock. In 1995, scientists discovered the existence of clock genes in a group of worms known as nematodes. A research team at McGill University in Montreal found that artificially induced mutations in these genes altered the frequency with which the nematodes ate and digested food and the rate at which they swam. The scientists tentatively concluded that the worms' clock genes worked together as a kind of master timepiece, synchronizing all their life functions and their interaction with their surroundings. Today, with our own persistent and universal sense of warped time, the reorchestrative possibilities for nematode life seem closely analogous to those for human beings. Our changing frame of reference. Real time is what I am calling our sense of ultra-compressed time and foreshortened horizons in these years of the millennial countdown. The change in our consciousness of time is the creation of ubiquitous programmable technology, producing results at the click of a mouse or the touch of a button or key. Real time occurs when time and distance vanish, when action and response are simultaneous. Many real-time processes and activities are obvious, most are not. We experience real time while watching live TV coverage of an event on the other side of the globe, or while withdrawing money at an ATM. We experience real time when our credit card is verified in seconds, when we check our blood pressure at home. These instances of instant satisfaction change our frame of reference. They provide different patterns and signals for setting expectations and for judging what is reality, what is truth or fiction, what is good or bad service, what is satisfaction. The cultural and value-laden patterns of our society change as we are taught by our environment to adapt to new ways of doing things. We all now expect to be able to dial directly to establish a telephone connection with almost any place in the world in seconds, to scan galaxies of information on the internet in minutes, to establish our creditworthiness in the seconds it takes to slide a plastic card through a slot, to test on our own the level of glucose or cholesterol in our blood, to administer pregnancy tests with home diagnostic kits, to send and receive overnight packages from London or Tokyo, to fax letters to friends in Reykjavik and Manila, commission customized shirts and suits to be delivered in a week, to bank 24 hours a day, to turn board meetings into teleconferences of directors scattered over three continents, to follow O.J. Simpson as he flees in his white Bronco, to watch a war in progress in the Middle East. You might reasonably object that the phenomenon I'm calling real time is actually more like unreal time. Its reframing of the familiar has much in common with the radical conceptual shift in 20th century physics toward the realm of quantum mechanics, in which subatomic matter is seen to act like both waves and particles, and to be in more than one place at a time. In any case, real time is a phrase I have borrowed from computer culture, in which the usual meanings of words are almost routinely altered, if not reversed, where default is taken to mean standard, dedicated means restricted, and icon, reduced to one of its many meanings, means symbol. Originally, real time meant enormous computer power capable of instantaneous input and output response. The computer executed instructions as they were generated. The original impetus for this rapid program execution came from military applications, such as fighter aircraft, where human reflexes were simply too slow to direct them. In my use of the term, real time applies not to any device, but to the technologically transformed context of everything we do. Real time is characterized by the shortest possible lapse between idea and action, between initiation and result. In the context of business, a real-time experience is created from self-service and self-satisfaction by customers. It is instant response. On the cusp of the age of real-time, technological progress looks as if it is accomplished by hidden catalytic agents. The world as we know it is being changed subtly beneath familiar surfaces. Cellular phones are taking the wild out of wilderness. Climbers phone home from the slopes of Mount Everest. Hikers, hunters, and Boy Scouts dial out for directions rather than navigate for themselves. The catalytic agents behind these modifications of our experience are all born of information technology. They all love speed. They all seek real time. This is an experience of time shaped by the proliferation of a variety of communications technologies and a myriad of chip-sized computers embedded in devices that are everywhere around us, from the moment we open our eyes in the morning. The average American home today has hundreds of intelligent microchips executing computing, controlling, and programming tasks, not just in personal computers, but in VCRs, television sets, microwave ovens, power tools, thermostats, security systems, telephones, answering machines, calculators, fax machines, pocket calculators, wristwatches, alarm clocks, portable and stationary tape and disc players, baby monitors, and stereo systems, as well as in dozens of other gadgets and countless toys. The future is out, now is in. Close to three decades ago, in Future Shock, Alvin Toffler anticipated the waves of trauma, anxiety, and panic that the riptide of the technological revolution, with its accelerated pace of change, would set off. Toffler clearly communicated how difficult it would be to live in a real-time world, one in which surprises lurk around every corner. To the extent that we cannot see up ahead, he warned, our ability to cope with the future diminishes. As he puts it, whether the problem is that of driving a car down a crowded street, piloting a plane, or dealing with interpersonal difficulties, performance improves when an individual knows what to expect next. As much as I admire Toffler and his rationale, I believe that a quarter century after his prescient work, we owe ourselves a constructive consideration of the possibilities of life lived on fast forward. We will increasingly find that the technologies of speed will not give us the time to see or plan beyond the horizon. We will have to think and act in real time. We cannot choose to do otherwise. We can and must get better at what we do best. Adaptability and a love of speed are quintessentially American qualities and must be reckoned among our finest comparative advantages. It is no accident that the land of the 90-second McDonald's hamburger, instant tanning lotion, and self-service hotel checkout is also home to more personal computers, more networked computers, and more wireless communications devices than any other nation. The benefit of short-term thinking. Companies large and small are playing to classic American strengths when they do not embrace the technologies of speed as ends in themselves, but work to comprehend the widest and most subtle consequences of their adoption. One of these consequences, I believe, is an even greater orientation toward the short term. Never mind if it has become a cliché to accuse American business and Wall Street of too much short-term thinking. The positive side of this trait is a hair-trigger responsiveness as measured against the standards of European or Japanese companies. For sure, there are times when a focus on more distant horizons richly benefits other business cultures at our expense. For instance, in some boom cycles, American semiconductor companies have lost market share to Japanese competitors that, with an eye to future demand, invested more heavily in production capacity. At these times, CEOs of American chipmakers have cursed the financial markets for making it impossible, given the certainty with which plummeting stock ratings follow diminished short-term profitability, to lay on all the extra capacity their companies are capable of. Yet the relentless application of Wall Street's quarter-by-quarter yardstick for success and competitiveness also accounts for the unmatched pace of innovation among American chipmakers. For all businesses, the speed of change, competitive response, and adaptation is interpreted by Wall Street as evidence of savvy management. Admittedly, companies in Japan, Europe, and other parts of the world are also speeding up their operations and developing innovative ways to address the real-time marketplace. But my focus in this book is the American marketplace. This is because America presents a real-time microcosm in which we might first expect to see adopted, technologically as well as socially, the concepts and practices that will soon be diffused throughout the world. American companies are actually evidence that an emphasis on short-term considerations is the best guarantor of long-term strength and competitiveness. For this seeming paradox, there is a parallel in long-distance running. You do not train for marathons by running marathons every day, but by running shorter distances in sprints. Sprinting improves control of breathing as well as muscle tone and endurance. This training prepares the runner for the long haul. The pressure for short-term results also goes hand in hand with an attitude prized in American industry. This is pragmatism, or the attitude encapsulated in the saying, "The best is the enemy of the good." In analyzing the reasons for the huge lead American companies have over the Japanese in software, for example, Stanford University researchers mentioned this cultural bias, among other factors. Good enough quality, they said, is acceptable in the United States. In an industry in which time to market is critical, Japanese companies are handicapped by a culture that exalts perfectionism. American companies believe in getting that new product out the door as fast and as cheap as possible, opting to back it up with a variety of technical and support services. Japanese companies delay product introductions for the sake of extensive quality assurance and testing procedures. And the Stanford team's overall conclusion? The U.S. economic, organizational, and cultural context fosters adaptation during periods of extremely rapid change in technology. Instant success takes time. While many companies are speeding up their various internal processes, minimizing procedures, and eliminating costly delays, application of the most powerful real-time concept, using an information feedback loop from customers and market infrastructure to design and service and back out again, has barely begun. Most approaches today are fragmented, not part of a unified business strategy. Real-time is emphatically not about simple acceleration or merely doing faster what organizations have done before, nor is it specifically about the Internet, although the World Wide Web is unquestionably a real-time technology. Companies best equipped for the 21st century will consider investment in real-time systems as essential to maintaining their competitive edge and keeping their customers. By this, I mean that they will use information and telecommunications technology to respond to changing circumstances and, even more important, customer expectations within the smallest possible lapse of time. They will understand that real-time is about exceptional responsiveness. They will understand that customers' expectations are being reset for hyper-accelerated, if not immediate, company response, no matter what they happen to be buying. The competitive environment will no longer tolerate slow response or delayed decision-making. Creating a real-time organization will be similar to the exercise of implementing total quality management, TQM. In the 1980s, many companies striving to improve the quality of their products and services discovered that attention to quality was not just a discrete step in the management process. The importance of quality had to be embedded in the thinking of every person in the organization. Implementing TQM was and still is a difficult and challenging process. So is deploying real-time processes and systems. Managing the information technology behind the ultra-responsiveness of real-time is not a job that can be delegated to a chief information officer or any other kind of specialist. It requires total management engagement. This is not to say that leaders of successful real-time organizations will have to turn themselves into computer programmers, but they will have to grasp and act on the ramifications of real-time. How can organizations be prepared to reconceptualize what they do in this way? First, by exposing people at all levels of the company to examples of successful adaptations to real-time thinking and operation, ways of developing channels for interactive relationships with customers and building customer communities, using information technology networks to generate and test new ideas and innovate faster, educating and training customers in new and labor-saving ways of accomplishing their ends by building instructions into technologies located in or accessible from their houses or offices or even cars. I recently gave a talk to a group of visiting Japanese businessmen and was asked this question. In the year 2010, will the computer or the TV set be the information appliance in the home? This is a matter hotly debated in the communications field, the assumption being that anyone who knows the answer to the question will simply build the right product before anyone else does. The device will be the microwave oven, I said. My audience smiled. Some even chuckled aloud. I assured them that I was not joking. If information is piped into the home and distributed like electricity, I explained, then any device can become a smart information appliance. Julia Child could pop up on the microwave flat panel screen to advise on the latest recipe for pasta just downloaded from a database in Italy. Real-time wrecks hierarchical organizations by making possible instant access to activities of all stripes, anywhere, anytime, all the time. Instead of fruitlessly trying to predict the future course of a competitive or market trend, customer behavior, or demand, managers should be trying to find and deploy all the tools that will enable them, in some sense, to be ever-present, ever-vigilant, and ever-ready in the brave new marketplace in gestation, where information and knowledge are ceaselessly exchanged. Managers dedicated to making the future happen will, in some ways, be preparing for the eventuality of anything. Technology and society shape and reshape each other ceaselessly, like tireless meshing gears in a perpetual motion machine. This is nothing new, yet in the 20th century, the scale of the interchange and its consequences for people and social institutions have far exceeded anything seen in previous eras. The new technology, shaping the social fabric. Over the last 100 years, the idea of fomenting common aspirations within a mass culture or consumer society was inspired by the technologies of production and communication. As early as 1903, the metaphor of mass production had insinuated itself into social thinking. The public school system of this country, wrote one correspondent of the New York Times that year, is a great factory where the raw material from foreign lands is manufactured into patriotic American citizens with the language, the sentiments, the patriotism, the manners, the customs, and the national aspirations of Americans. Technology's effects on us today are different from those of the Industrial Revolution. They are more democratic, more personal, more subtle, and profound. They are changing our very perceptions and judgments of value, our loyalties and relationships. They are changing who we are, even as we casually press each new technological marvel into service, taking it for granted. The signs are all around us. They are reflected in two stories on a single page of a recent issue of the New York Times. One reported on the results of an opinion poll by the advertising agency Saatchi & Saatchi, in which women were asked for their views on the depiction of their sex in TV commercials. Participants in the survey particularly admired an Apple computer ad in which a woman shown working at home on a PC, juggling the demands of children and a ringing telephone, puts together a report that later wins praise from her boss. The survey supervisor at Saatchi said that the participating women liked the depiction of the improvisational woman who makes it up as she goes along and has got it together. They saw the commercial as needed encouragement during a period of turmoil, inordinate time pressure, and insecurity caused by women's changing roles. But it was technology, from modern appliances to the birth control pill, that gave women the option to alter their roles and stretch their definitions of themselves. In the age of real time, given the opportunity to pack even more into a day and live out still other identities, most women will take it. They will want devices like the one that was the subject of the other story in the Times that day. A new AT&T cellular telephone with a tiny three-line display screen, integrating voice and internet services, capable of browsing the World Wide Web, and permitting absolutely no excuse for not answering email from anywhere. They will want the rival technologies and products that AT&T's competition will offer, catering to their desire to stretch even farther. Technology alters semi-conscious and subconscious notions of community and heritage. In his 1990 book, Time Passages, George Lipsitz observes, "Time, history, and memory become qualitatively different concepts in a world where electronic mass communication is possible. Instead of relating to the past through a shared sense of place or ancestry, consumers of electronic mass media can experience a common heritage with people they have never seen. They can acquire memories of a past to which they have no geographical or biological connection. This capacity of electronic mass communication to transcend time and space creates instability by disconnecting people from past traditions. But it also liberates people by making the past less determinate of experiences in the present." A shift to people power. Most uncanny, perhaps, is the link between the evolution of computers and the shift in the self-image of two successful generations of Americans. In the era of big impersonal corporations and big remote mainframe computers housed in sterile rooms, a time in which the managerial ideal was the trusty robot-like organization man, alienated workers felt that they were treated like numbers on computer cards. The next generation, benefiting from educational opportunities unknown to its parents, refused to accept these metaphors as models for their own lives. Explaining the underlying cause of the rebellion in a speech on the Berkeley campus in 1964, the student leader Mario Savio said, "It is the alienation that students feel from what is a knowledge factory. You're processed. You become a number on a set of file cards that go through an IBM machine." Student protest placards of that year read, "I am a student. Do not fold, bend, or mutilate." The personal computer, a symbol of egalitarianism and individualism, was the brainchild of that same counterculture revolution, whose rallying cry was power to the people. Here was an example of society reforming technology. Apple computer co-founder Steve Jobs famously warned, "Never trust a computer you can't lift," precisely echoing the cultural revolutionary's motto, "Never trust anyone over 30. Yet technology does not always suit society's wants and expectations so neatly. It has brought distressing social fragmentation. More and more, an expanding range of real-time communications capabilities puts people from all walks of life on call 24 hours a day, like emergency room doctors. Advanced communications are breaching sovereign borders and putting unprecedented powers into the hands of individuals capable of executing transactions and moving various forms of information and capital in and out of markets on a global scale. The gap widens between the world's information elite and information have-nots, who have only limited contact with computers and networks, or none. Half of the world's population has yet to make a telephone call. There are serious and fully warranted concerns about the future effects of information and communications technologies on society. A license to speed. Unlike the inventions of the Industrial Revolution or the many technological innovations that followed it, real-time technologies have permeated society like clandestine catalytic agents, their speed and media of transmission freeing them from past constraints. Until the mid to late 1970s, large companies, big government, and a handful of powerful educational institutions largely controlled the distribution of technological innovation. Government had a hand in establishing and running the railroads, telegraph service, radio and television broadcasting, and the pharmaceutical and mainframe computer industries. Most significant technologies of the 20th century have been regulated in some form or other. Indeed, government permission is required to operate most of these technologies. For instance, I need a license to drive a car or to run a radio or TV station. As a result, innovation seeped out slowly and deliberately. In contrast, the makers and users of personal computers today do not need a license to operate, nor do the millions of internet surfers and users of fax machines. Indeed, types and forms of computing and communication are changing so rapidly that the regulators at the Federal Communications Commission, as well as most other large established institutions, are hard-pressed to keep up with them. Modems, satellite dishes, and fax machines proliferate, and information moves back and forth seamlessly across the borders of even the most closed societies. As a result, the rapid changes and effects of real-time technologies are rapidly absorbed and adapted by those who use them. No agent of the Industrial Revolution could have insinuated itself into the culture so stealthily. I can still vividly recall driving along the Boulevard of the Allies by the Monongahela River in Pittsburgh in the 1940s and 1950s. The steel mills and their blast furnaces lined the waterfront like visions from Dante's Inferno. Molten metal poured from ladles reflected against the evening sky in explosions of crimson light. There was no escaping the physical evidence of the mass production process. Rail cars and trucks loaded with steel, polluted rivers, and murky skies. The silent power of silicon. While the steam engines and colossal mills that moved people off farms and into factories announced their presence with grinding and hissing, the silicon chips responsible for the information revolution expressed their intelligence through the silent and imperceptible movements of electrons. It is as if a new dimension has been given to Adam Smith's idea of the invisible hand of capitalism, working toward universal economic well-being. In the pathways of the microchip, also known as a silicon chip or semiconductor, embedded elements hustle electrons through decision-making gates, which work in Boolean logic at the levels of ones and zeros to say and, or not, and onto other chips, where they will be stored or used to trigger or amplify action. There are chips that produce sound, video images, and laser light, chips that calculate, remember, regulate, amplify, control, and communicate. Though their variety is endless, they have in common ease of integration and their consequent capacity to speed up what were once discrete tasks. For me, there is an abiding sense of the miraculous about the embedded channels in the microchips through which electrons move at speeds of millionths of a second. The state of the art in the so-called line widths of these channels is submicron technology. A micron is 1/1,000,000 of a meter, or the width of a human hair. Chips can contain up to several million submicron pathways moving information in the form of electrons from input to output. In between, more than 1,000,000 logic gates or decision points are jammed onto a piece of silicon little bigger than a contact lens. Semiconductors are manufactured in batches on silicon wafers containing hundreds of discrete chips, resulting in a clockwork decline in production costs at the rate of 30% a year for 1 year after another. For more than three decades, the cost-performance ratio of chips has adhered to Moore's Law, which refers to the staggering, steadily exponential advance in the logic density of microchips. Their raw processing power doubles every 18 months. The physical and psychological distance between this technology's forges and the rest of society, quite unlike Pittsburgh steelmaking, can be illustrated in the very pronunciation of the word silicon. A number of people, news commentators, politicians, actors, mispronounce the name of this basic raw material of the information revolution. Silicon is a derivative of silica, the most abundant element in nature next to oxygen. People in the semiconductor industry, the industry that gave Silicon Valley its name, have long pronounced the word as silicon. Webster's, on the other hand, rules that the con in silicon should rhyme with the bon in carbon. Neither source supplies any ground for the popular confusion in which silicon is pronounced as a homonym for silicone, a synthetic petrochemical and the stuff of controversial breast implants. Yet whether one hears silicone, silicon, or silicon in reference to computers or communications technology, the concept itself is proliferating, and its meaning is clear: advanced technology inside. But then part of the entertainment of my 30-plus years in Silicon Valley has come from observing both the development of information technologies and their rapid sifting into every crevice of a society largely oblivious to them. I cannot say whether I am more astonished by the dimensions of that obliviousness or by the phenomenal computational power and speed that silicon chips have made possible. Today's laptop computers deliver more than 100 times the performance of the typical engineering workstations of 1985. In a mere greeting card, a singing or talking microchip carries more computing moxie than those first computers of the 1950s, even though their difference in size is proportionately greater than that between a hot dog stand and a skyscraper. Microchips are the hardware undergirding the rising fuel efficiency of cars, the instantaneous transfer of funds between continents, the digital music so uncannily true to the auditory nuances of live concerts, the criminal fingerprint and photographic records relayed to police officers in their cars, and a grocery store's ability to manage 30,000 or more items on its shelves. But the products with a capacity most radically enlarged by microchips, those of the communications industry, have been spawning yet another societal sea change. This one is already dwarfing the information revolution in the scope of its ramifications and reverberations. From computing to communicating. Communication systems are most prone to being transformed by progress in computers because of the huge overlap between their respective means and ends. Computers work by manipulating and communicating digital data composed of bits that can represent almost any form of information: voice, data, text, sound, graphics, video, touch, pressure, heat, and light. Until recently, computers were principally used as machines working with other machines, while communications technologies directly served people as channels uniting them. With the advent of distributed computing, digital data can now move over networks, including networks stretching from continent to continent, exactly like data inside a single computer. By the same token, the critical components of modern communication systems are now computers. For instance, the modern switch managing the millions of phone call connections at your local telephone company is a digital computer. Software and silicon might be seen as the yin and yang of real time. Software plays a vital role in digital technology by providing rapid adaptability or programmability for almost any application, including many in communications. It can even extend the life of older technologies or rapidly upgrade them. For the past 100 years, copper wire has been installed on telephone poles and in the ground. Today, software artifacts such as data packets and software techniques such as data compression make it possible for bits to move at lightning speed over those wires, which are now positively geriatric. A global nervous system. Within the next decade or so, satellite systems will house chip-sized digital computers capable of moving voice, data, and video bits to the remotest regions of China, Africa, and Borneo. The result will be explosive growth in demand for digital technology. Competition and technology will drive costs down as a global communications highway emerges. Communication content, as varied as the people who have access to this infrastructure and residing in millions of computers on every continent, will move around as if in a single giant information processor. As Scott McNeely, president of Sun Microsystems, correctly prophesied more than a decade ago, quote, "The network is the computer," end quote. This vision is now taking shape around the planet. Soon, global internetworking, networks linked to other networks like the Internet with hybrid fiber, coaxial cable, cellular, and satellite transmissions, will be responsible for unimaginable leaps in bandwidth, which is to say, communications capacity. Computer networks that today transmit data at megabits, millions a second, will soon be graduating to a rate of gigabits, billions a second, creating a universe of broadband communications. Consider for scale that the human voice communicates at a snail's pace of about 55 bits a second. Businesses, organizations, governments, and individuals are finding the quickly growing World Wide Web to be a rapid and economical way of communicating to their employees, partners, and customers. Databases that were once accessible to only a few are now online, bringing untold volumes of information, ranging from sports statistics, news articles, government demographic data, library holdings, and tourist information, to newspaper and magazine subscriptions, astronomy pictures, rock concerts, and Shakespeare's complete works, to broad communities of interest. As more and more computers are added to the network, they create increased demand by adding a new community of people interested in accessing the particular information provided. The pipeline, or network, does not have the capacity, or bandwidth, to handle the millions of simultaneous transactions that may occur. As a result, computer and telecommunications companies are feverishly working to develop new software for compressing data and higher-speed chips and computers to move bits faster. The entire Internet industry is running on real time in an effort to put into place an efficient infrastructure with the hope that the content made available will have value. What does all this gee-whizzery amount to? Once, computers chiefly ground away at numbers that they then organized, stored, and printed out in reams of categorized data, lists, payroll records, accounting data, and inventory reports for a few managers to peruse. As bandwidth expands, images of extraordinary complexity will be transmittable. You could say that a picture or a graph will in the future be worth not 100 words, but 100 million words. Now, computer power at the service of communications delivers information where and when it is needed, and in a form chosen by the user. Soon, managers interacting with each other with unprecedented intellectual and emotional intimacy will turn bits into ideas, action, and response. For the consumer, this phase of technological progress will serve interests and desires closer to the human heart, like the real-time news coverage that satellites have made possible. People all around the globe were able to share the excitement of the crowds tearing down the Berlin Wall and the passion of the students striking blows for freedom in Tiananmen Square. Thanks to satellites, Himalayan tribes in the almost inaccessible area of Arunachal in India now watch soap operas and other famous programming from America and Bombay. In far northeast India, Mountain Tribes Meet the World, an article in the Washington Post, writer Molly Moore recounted one instance of intergenerational conflict caused by this new electronic propinquity, as told by a disgruntled Nishi tribesman. "My son insists that I wear trousers and says I should get rid of my headdress and cut my hair." Satellite television has introduced foreign programming into nearly 20 million Indian households, whose choice of TV fare only 10 years ago was limited to a single dull government-run channel called Doordarshan. There are more than 40 channels on tap in India today, and more than 100 more are expected to be launched by the year 2000 by international communications leaders such as Sony, Columbia, Sky, Star, Time Warner, HBO, and Disney, either in partnership with Indian companies or independently. Indian TV personality Vibha Chhabra notes one of the remarkable effects of this evolution, the liberalization of sexuality, or at least of the willingness to talk about it. India, the country that gave the world the Kama Sutra, the 4th century guide to lovemaking, in subsequent centuries experienced something like an eclipse of eroticism. For most of this century, even kissing has been prohibited in Indian movies by government order. Now, thanks to Sky-based video networks, all this is changing. On Sunday nights, viewers all across India turn on their television sets to Purush Kshetra, India's first sexual advice television show. Confessions on everything from sexual dysfunction to female orgasm are on public display. Judging from the fan mail it receives, the program has succeeded in unleashing the Indian viewer's libido. What would a visitor from a previous generation, brought up on conservative Victorian values, make of a whole population absorbed in contemplation of flickering images, communicating information and advice on the passions of love and lust? Years before the collapse of the Soviet Union, former Premier Mikhail Gorbachev said, "No country can today isolate its economic, political, or social environment from any other nation." Thanks to satellites, his remark has proved even more prescient than he might have imagined. Satellites have had an extraordinary influence on business and consumers over the last 20 years, and we have hardly seen anything yet. In the next decade, some 1,700 satellites will be launched into space, creating the potential for more than 3 billion people to view CNN, make a phone call, tap into the information highway, or watch reruns of Seinfeld and The X-Files. Assimilation will be swift. Our modern communication system is the result of more than half a century of planting copper wires in the ground, over our heads, and in our walls. The 21st century's infrastructure of satellites, ground stations, and wireless networks is being put in place in a fraction of that time. Computer nerds and neophytes alike are being united in quasi-communities founded on whizzing bits. A global nervous system is being assembled, linking ideas, information, images, and the cultural repositories of nations, the whole Pandora's box of human affairs that can be tapped into by anyone with a telephone, a TV, a personal computer, or a device that combines all three. Technology trends of recent years and of today very clearly constitute the past that will serve as prologue to that future. 25 years ago, there were fewer than 25,000 computers on the planet. More than 200 million computers are in use today. In the United States, the average metropolitan area has more than 50 cable and TV stations, and that number will double over the next 5 years. Around 1983, Europe had some 80 TV stations. It now has more than 800. Sitting at home, surfing the internet, we can reach a bank in Helsinki, take a math course at Washington State University, and scan weather patterns over East Africa. Comfortably ensconced in my home office, I have toured an exhibition of Civil War photographs at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., and traveled from Sri Lanka to Lithuania, where I explored maps, photos, and other information on Lithuania's public access servers. I have watched, in real time, via streaming video, an eclipse of the moon. The communications revolution is tilting the balance of power from institutions to individuals. We once feared an Orwellian Big Brother. Instead, it is big institutions that are bridling at the uncontrolled and prolific dissemination of sensitive information. Empowered by the Freedom of Information Act and with ready access to databases, journalists and private citizens alike have powerful tools for getting and using data once guarded closely by government agencies and private corporations. Stockholders have access to the CEO's salary and the perks that go with the job. They can monitor insider trading daily. Outsiders satisfy their curiosity about companies' compensation programs and competitive tactics and strategies. Hackers and computer pirates scale electronic walls to steal military secrets and can, if they choose, help themselves to more mundane information about people's spending habits, debts, traffic tickets, and medical records. An experiment in direct democracy. Radios, fax machines, satellites, and the World Wide Web are unhampered by any rusted iron curtain or barbed wire. In 1991, shortly after the attempted coup of the Gorbachev regime in the Soviet Union, my wife Diane and I ran into an old friend and former presidential hopeful, Gary Hart, as he was shopping in London. He was on his way to Moscow to meet with the Soviet foreign minister, Eduard Shevardnadze, and asked us if he knew where he could buy a fax machine nearby. Apparently, that was the one thing Shevardnadze had asked him to bring with him. Faxes and computer communications were the safest and most confidential way to maintain the links established between the many pro-democracy groups during the crisis. The only way to stay one step ahead of the communist apparatchiks was to send information in the form of bits rather than by voice. The latest wave of technological progress is making representative democracy seem increasingly unsatisfactory. Certainly, the new technologies could hasten a worldwide transition to direct democracy, truer to its ancient Athenian origins, in which every citizen's judgment was given equal weight in matters of government. This kind of democracy is now practiced only in Switzerland. As noted in The Economist, in Switzerland, it is possible to insist, by collecting a modest number of signatures, that any law proposed by the government must be submitted to a vote of the whole people. Australia and some parts of the Western United States also now use referendums in a fairly regular way. There have even started to be referendums in Europe outside Switzerland. Elsewhere, democracy is still stuck in a halfway house, as it were, in which the